Clark County.
My name is Ron Onslow, and I give you a history, but it's too long.
We don't have that much time.
Jim Hodges, City of Camas.
Dave Scott, Washougal.
Jeff Swanson, La Center.
Samantha Whitley with Clark County.
Rebecca Royce with Clark County.
Julie Olson, Clark County.
Mike Forrest, Clark County.
Thank you. All right, so approval of the October 14, 2019 meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, first meeting of the year, we get to elect a new vice chair. Does anybody have to be the other vice chair?
You're the current vice chair, reveal yourself.
I'm fine.
Do we hear any nominations for vice chair?
I nominate Counselor Onslow.
I second the nomination.
There you go.
A nomination and a second. Any other nominations? One more time, any other nominations? All those in favor of Counselor Onslow as vice chair, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
I was able to find our minutes, and it was Counselor Onslow last year also.
Oh, it was.
I did that.
You can always pass the crown.
Well, as long as Julie shows up, we're good.
All right. Well, we'll just maintain status quo then, shall we? 2020 available funding.
Sam, do you want to go over that?
Yeah. So, on December 23rd, Congress passed and the President signed the FY 2020 funding bill for HUD, and that gave $1.35 billion for home funding, which is $100 million more than last year, and $3.4 billion for CDBG, which is $100 million more than last year.
That comes to us.
Trickles down with the allocations.
Can't siphon that off to build the west side of the 502.
Just checking.
So we should probably be getting about, if all the jurisdictions are the same, we should be maybe seeing about a 3% increase in CDBG, 7% increase in home, based on the federal funding. But we're just going to base our awards on flat level funding from last year. So then we'll have a little wiggle room once we get the allocation from HUD.
And that will be like roughly March,
yes.
I think.
We give our best estimate in March, and we pull any funding that wasn't spent or that was returned, and so we have a better idea of what our awarded amounts will be. But then it seems like HUD actually lets us know in April. Like, it's always pushing a little bit further than our award meeting when we really need it.
So what if we would do the math on that 7% or 3%, what would be the estimated dollars that
Oh, so we have about $800,000 that we allocate for housing, $350,000 that we allocate for the asset and economic development section, and then about $850,000 for infrastructure and public facilities. I'm not that good with math, so I'll just agree with what you're saying.
About 60.
So we had about 800, 300, we had a million, right?
Well, 800, 300, and another 800.
1.6 million.
Yeah, so.
Nine, seven, six,
I did a 3%, sorry.
Oh, okay.
So
7%.
Yes. Okay. Well, I always do the conservative estimate. But so between, from low end to an additional 60 to a high end of like additional 100.
Okay.
It'll help round up instead of round down.
So we have 800 for facilities and improvements. Is that what I heard?
I looked at our last 3 years of awards because we switched the categories around this year. We used to do a CDBG and home, and now we're doing it based on infrastructure, public facilities, asset, and housing. So for infrastructure, that's the streets and sidewalks and utilities, $550,000. And then for public facilities or social service activities, like community centers or nonprofit improvements, $300,000. For asset and economic development, that would be like the micro enterprise assistance and home ownership programs, about $350,000. And then for the housing, new construction or rental assistance, $800,000.
With possible 3% and 7% increases.
Yes.
And where, which one would get seven? Just the bottom one, just the 800,000.
Right. Okay. That's the home funding. There, there can be some home funding in the asset, in the home ownership category as well. Yep, I'm here. I'll do it. So we received six applications for public facilities and neighborhood improvements. The three infrastructure applications were the City of Battleground, City of Camas, and City of Ridgefield. Battleground Southeast Clark Avenue improvements is requesting $129,200. Camas Northwest 12th Avenue is requesting $255,000. Ridgefield Simon Street is requesting $255,000, so that comes to a total of $639,200. And I think you just wrote down the $550,000 that's probably about available in that category. And then for the social service activities, City of Washougal's social service building is requesting $227,000. The VHA is requesting some additional improvements to their Orchards Inn family shelter for $244,332. And then the VHA is also requesting some improvements for their Safe Choice domestic violence shelter, $200,000. And they're also requesting money from the city. So our total social service requests are $671,332 and roughly $300,000 available in that category. Under asset and economic development, I have four applications. Hispanic Chambers requesting an ongoing program for small business assistance at $73,200. Mercy Corps is new this year. I've met with them. Their program is similar to Hispanic Chamber, but they also offer grants to the businesses as they're getting launched. So that's an interesting program. And they have worked in different areas in Washington, but they're a Portland agency. They're requesting $50,000. They're also requesting funding from the City of Vancouver, but it's since this money will only serve county residents, the $50,000 is only serving county residents, so it's not considered a joint application. North Bank Innovations is an interesting new applicant, and I reached out to him several times, and I wasn't able to get all of our questions answered. It looks like it actually won't be eligible for funding because the office that he's planning to set up is within the City of Vancouver, and they didn't apply to the city at all. I think they will need to do that next year. So you can disregard that one. I'm going to send them a letter that it's not going to work out, unfortunately. And then we have Proud Ground, their ongoing land trust program for home ownership, and they're requesting $300,000. So if you take out North Bank, it looks like we have $423,200 in requests and about $350,000 that we will award. And then for our affordable housing and homelessness category, we have three TIBRA applications, Janice Youth, The Nest for rental assistance for youth, 15 youth. They're requesting $120,000. Lifeline is requesting rental assistance for 15 of their clients with behavioral health disorders of $87,500. And SHARE is requesting rental assistance program continuation for homeless adults and families. They are planning to serve 41 households with $300,000. And then we have two new construction, one acquisition, one rehab application. Columbia Nonprofit Housing is looking for some money for Laurel Manor Senior Housing. That's 40 units in Hazeldale. are requesting $300,000. Mercy Housing Northwest is looking to construct 70 units up near the hospital in Salmon Creek for $250,000, also requested $250,000 from the City of Vancouver. Second Step Housing is looking to, again, acquire more market units. They were awarded funds for that last year. They're still looking for housing on our 2019 award, but they'd like to request $300,000 in housing funds to look for other units as well, and $100,000 from the City of Vancouver. And then VHA would like to rehab the Central Park Place SROs that are over between Clark College and the VA. They're requesting $200,000 from the county and $200,000 from the city. So our total applications for the affordable housing and homelessness is $1,557,500, anticipating a little over $800,000 to award. One thing that came up for two agencies that the county has an e-verify requirement, and two of the agencies were unable to meet that requirement because of the way they're structured or the way their HR works. And we also had one of the small cities that had a little bit of trouble with it this year. So that's just something to be aware of. Hacienda CDC wasn't able to apply to meet the e-verify requirement. And the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce also was not able to make that happen. So it's just an FYI.
So what's our timing? Is that okay, another topic? When do we start?
So staff has already gotten most of the way through these and is asking applicants questions that they'll have until the end of the month to answer, and or maybe we'll tighten that up a little bit. Maybe give them 2 weeks to answer so that we can get these applications out to all of you to review. The applicants, the feedback that I've gotten on Neighborly is that the applicants liked it. I'm not sure how this, I don't know if the scoring is going to be as easy as it was in Zoom Grants. I hope it's at least comparable. And we'll launch passwords to everybody and do a little cheat sheet on where to click and how to score. I want to say by the end of this month.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
So for the quarter ending September of 2019, you have all the information on the spreadsheet here about where the projects are doing. I thought I would just give a little update about how they've been doing since then. The Washougal K Street neighborhood project, that has been complete for quite a while. We have literally one document that I'm waiting from a subcontractor for their certified payroll. I have their invoice and everything ready and approved. I cannot finalize it until we have the one document from the subcontractor, which is why it's so important that we work with the prime contractors to work with the subcontractors to get that document, because it is held up payment to Washougal. I think I've had the invoice on my desk for 2 months now, just trying to get one document. The Ridgefield 8th Avenue project is completely done and closed out. Woodland is also complete and taken care of. The ESD 112 modular is complete, project is fully complete. The FFC group home acquisition is done. They had their open house a couple weeks ago, and tenants are in the house. The Salvation Army's new community center has been done, and they had their open house. It's a beautiful building. I was able to attend. The Vancouver Housing Authority's Orchard Inn shelter improvements is now under construction. You go to the next page. Ridgefield South 3rd Avenue project. The environmental review is complete, and I believe the contract is fully executed. The Washougal Hathaway Elementary sidewalks is now under construction. Columbia River Mental Health's Elahan Place upgrades is contract is fully executed, and they are in the design process. And then Shares elevator replacement project. The construction itself and the modernization is complete. They are waiting and trying to figure out a last little glitch between the fire marshal and the permit and the actual construction. Something about when the fire door comes down, it wasn't giving enough of a gap So they were trying to get that figured out. So the last little piece for that project. With Proud Ground, they had one house close right before Christmas. Second step is actively looking for properties. They submitted a couple of different properties for review, but unfortunately things haven't worked out quite yet. And then the VBT Grand Boulevard project, they now have all other funding in place. So that one is ready to proceed. And then on the back page is our tenant-based rental assistance programs, which are, for the most part, chugging along, providing rental assistance and case management services.
With the exception of Lifeline, who has not yet served a single tenant, but they did apply for 2020 funds.
It's important to know.
Yes.
And we'll remind you of that when, and what the status is when you're actually scoring applications. But, and one other thing, just for your awareness, with the second set housing six-unit acquisition project, we occasionally get requests from Second Step as, you know, they're diligently moving forward and trying to do the acquisition, acquire, and sometimes you get requests that are, you know, changing the nature of the project, like to a redevelopment or a rehab, and I just want to make you aware that when we get those requests, like, the answer is no. Like, they have to do what they applied to do and were awarded funding to do. And I'm making you aware that, hey, because we had that interaction, that's not always the case for the City of Vancouver when they receive funds from, you know, from the city. The city is much more flexible, and once they get awarded the funds, they're much more flexible in terms of just getting them expended. I would be uncomfortable with that. I mean, you know, just because it's, you know, when we're ranking and scoring applications, whether or not they would have been awarded funds might be a different decision on your part if it were a different proposal. You know, and in fairness to the board, and in respect of how you rank it, and in respect of other applicants in the community, you know, we will really work hard with agencies to help them execute what they propose and expend those funds. We generally draw the line at not allowing them to change the nature of what they propose, if that makes any sense.
And so the City of Vancouver has made a different policy decision, and they're legally able to do that?
I don't know that they have a policy. I honestly don't know they have a policy behind it. And I don't know that it would pass muster in an audit or a monitoring of the FIHUD. We have different philosophy. I mean, honestly, and this, I'm not saying this in criticism of the City of Vancouver. You know, they run things differently. I have been in conversations with their program manager that handles homeless CDBG funds, and it's been articulated to me that when there's a monitoring, we're going to have findings. That's just the way it goes. And that's not how it goes here. You know, it just isn't. So, you know, I...
So what's an example of that? They want to build 10 new units, and instead they decide to buy an old place and fix it up, and it's 10 units. Is that an example?
The number of units might be different. It might be changing from an acquisition to rehab. It's some examples we've had difference in number of units and also in terms of actually buying lockables. Doing modular homes instead of doing a complete purchase and development construction thing as opposed to an acquire. So things like that.
Does HUD ever come and audit you? I thought they did.
Oh, well, they do, and we generally, you know, we do well. Like the last one, we had one finding which we took issue with and disputed, and without us doing any additional corrective action, HUD came back after seeing our review, and they didn't withdraw the finding, but they said that no corrective action was needed. So, we do get monitored, and we generally do well with the monitorings.
So obviously they do too, but
But I want to make you aware that that does happen behind the scenes. And that's not criticism of Second Step either. You know, they talk to us, they don't just change things, and they generally follow our advice and, you know, and our instruction. But because that interaction happens, and because the interaction they have with the city is a little different, I just want to make you aware of that. And Sam,
I can imagine that it's okay, because if you said it that way, you could also say it on a street. I decided not to do it on Main, we're going to do it on Broadway instead. And it's like, I don't know how you could get by with that. But.
And we would allow that if the proposal that you do, it, you know, doesn't identify the location, that says you're looking for a location, you know, just using that as an example. But if you're saying, like, we're making a proposal for doing this project in this location, and then the location changes, and what the project you're doing changes, we would say no. Yeah.
All right.
So, and Sam, is there anything you would add to any of what I shared?
No, I would just add on to what you said, that it's not because Second Step wants to bait and switch. It's that they're trying. They've made several offers. This property owner wanted too much, and then this property owner switched out in the middle to somebody else, and so it's just they're just trying to do whatever they can to meet their application that they submitted.
I totally echo that.
But if they couldn't, let's say they couldn't find the units to buy or the property to buy, they could say, okay, they could give the money back and they apply it for a different.
Correct.
And I would think if that was a scenario that the second application would come in, that they would get a little bit of love from the board because they do want to change what they're doing and they found a better way to do it.
Sure.
But we haven't really seen that, though, have we?
Not yet.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you so much. All right. Discuss bus tour date availability.
So you have a calendar. It's blank. No President's Day on the
17th.
Well, this is like for our planning purposes of the bus tours, or for you to, like, what works for you. And do you, usually there's the Association of Cities, some kind of meeting or conference that's happening
it's
in
on
this time frame? 28th
and 29th.
That's in January, though.
Oh, okay. So, last year, I believe it was on the around the 12th that we did the tour, but we will be flexible to what works best for the majority that are here.
Well,
so let us know what works.
Ron's schedule.
I'm good for the 12th.
So whatever the group decides is fine. I'm generally Wednesdays are generally a difficult day. Or
likewise, Wednesdays are a little tough for me.
Don't you want to be out of here on Wednesday? Sorry. Got to go out in the field.
Oh, the truth hurts.
And that was just what it was last year. Like, we have no investment in the 12th. So really, you know, if there are two of you that Wednesdays really do not work,
what's the deadline? When is the latest we should meet? Do the tour?
You know, so this is, there is no deadline because this is not a requirement. You know, this is not any kind of legislative program. This is something that we do so you can lay eyes on the proposals and help you evaluate them. So you will be receiving you will be going through proposals and doing the evaluation in February. And we will probably be doing the ranking, scoring, March. So, you know, so we're very flexible on this.
What day would you like the scoring in?
Do you remember? Do we have a date?
Well, our award meeting is March 9th, so we'll probably say March 5th, March 5th or 6th, to make sure we have everybody's information in there.
What's everyone's availability on the 11th?
I'm okay.
I think I'm okay too.
That would work for me.
Is there, how many, is it six or is it just three?
Three.
I'm, I, you know, I, I'm okay also. I don't know how to do this, so don't take my word for it completely, but I'm okay with bringing some pictures in of each battleground, Ridgefield, and who's the third one? They don't count. Camus. I'm okay with doing that instead of a bus. Also, I don't know what everybody else feels. However, I don't know how to do that, to put that up there. I can make sure that my city does it. You probably know how to do that.
So. We do. Yeah, that's fine as well.
So it's up to you guys.
Drone video.
Drone.
Progressive's got a drone. We could use that.
Washougal has a drone.
No.
We should get one.
We should. Yeah.
I mean, if you want to do the bus, that's great. I don't have any problem with the bus, and I'm okay on the 11th. If you want to do pictures, that's okay.
So do you want us to just fill this out and walk out the days and don't work? And
so last I heard, it sounds like the 11th, if we do a bus tour, the 11th is the date that seems to work for most, and we're happy to pursue that and schedule that. And, you know, we're open if you'd rather we bring pictures and show you pictures. And what I would recommend is if we do that, you know, the entity that has the proposal talk about, you know, when we show the pictures and stuff, just like you would in the bus tour, you know, you talk about, like, this is what we're planning on. Ideally, I think it'd be even better if the entity submitting the proposal took the pictures and sent them in.
Say that again.
Or a video.
Or a drone.
Well, it doesn't have to be a drone video. It could be a video. The entity that's submitting the proposal, send in some photos, and then also come present the project and talk about why they're applying if we don't do the bus tour.
We could do that at the February meeting with all the other presentations.
Yes,
it would just be part of that lineup.
I'd be fine with that, but we're not an applicant for neighborhood improvement money this year. We're an applicant for public facilities money. So I'm assuming we would be making a presentation on February 10th, no matter what. So it's selfish for me to say, oh, we don't need to do a bus tour because we don't have anything to present on a bus tour. Unless you wanted to come by, if we did a bus tour and you wanted to come by and see our building. But I would defer
now
to...
Now, I can ask, you know, can you get this done? Can you get some decent pictures?
I think in the past, the reason for the bus tour is you guys have... Look, I mean, we've been doing bus tours since before I got here, but I think you guys have looked at it as a easier way to, you know, you don't have to create a presentation, you don't have to have any different staff come to the UCPB and present, you know. And what I have heard in the past, I'm not trying to encourage you or discourage you in any way, but feedback we have gotten in the past, especially when electeds go, is that you're all stuck on a bus together, and it's one of the few opportunities to really, you know, talk about, you know, in a fairly open way about.
He won't
like, this
sit
is
next
what,
to me, so.
there's some other benefits to the bus tour.
Yeah.
Sure, but
so,
I,
but
I like the bus
to
tours myself. I think it just gives you a chance to go.
Fine with me.
I understand what your project is. I can see the context and where it's at in relationship to everything else. So
And sometimes, I will say this, sometimes on the bus tour, it's good that you are able to drive by maybe another project and show what the end result is, which is kind of nice.
And I do remember, I think it was year before last, you skillfully guided the bus under a church overhang and did some damage to the bus.
No, I did that on something
else.
Did
you put Ron behind the wheel?
No. He was kind of like giving the direction to
the driver. Wasn't one of those, no.
Yeah.
But I had done that.
The exit.
Just added to the list of wrecked golf carts and all kinds of other stuff.
I remember the guy from the church running out.
Yes.
few other things. You don't call me Chainsaw Ron for nothing.
So
it sounds like we'll schedule the bus tour then.
We'll plan for the 11th.
Does everybody want to meet in Battleground at the Community Center like we did last year? That seemed to work out fairly well. We have a project in Battleground to look at.
Works well with me.
Well, you end up in Ridgeville, so you're going to Uber back?
Oh, it works.
All right, 2020 draft work plan.
So if you grab this sheet that says UCPB work plan for 2020, the upper part says UCPB responsibilities is just a summary of the things that you do during the year. So in that context, the actual work plan is the table that you see below. We are doing January right now, but you can just look ahead. You know, February, you're looking at the social service home application presentations. You're looking at the bus tour. In March, you'll be receiving the HUD funding updates. You'll be receiving more, you know, again, quarterly reports. We will be doing scoring review and funding awards. June, you're looking at the update on the consolidated plan and action plan submission that Sam has been, all of us, but Sam especially, has really been working diligently on. January, March quarterly report, you know, we're doing, you know, every quarter we're giving you updates now. We're reviewing the point-in-time count and Homeless Connect data. We will be doing a program presentation, so something that you've already funded, we're going to ask that funder to come and tell us how they're doing. And then in October, CAPR review, quarterly report again, and prep you for the next request for proposals, the request for applications with an updated home and CDBG application review, you know, train you on that. So that's the, you know, the baseline of what we'd be looking at. That means we'll probably, that's the months we will likely be having UCPB meetings unless something additional comes up. And, you know, if we're happy to add to this work plan if you have any special requests or needs around that.
Comments, feedback, questions?
Sam, do you have any comments, feedback? Anything I missed?
No, does anybody on the board have any requests for program presentation, like something that you've been wondering about? We did our rehab program last year. I think we've talked about the tenant-based rental assistance we're certainly open to whatever you'd like to hear about.
You know, I'm really curious. The topic in the county right now is as it relates to, you know, homeless policy and camp cleanup, things like that, or shelter bed space. I'd be curious to hear. I think we had Vancouver Housing Authority was upgrading their shelter, mm-hmm. one of these shelter spaces. And I'm also sort of interested generally about shelter bed space and any funds that are moving toward new and additional shelter beds. It's just going to be part of the conversation we have.
Sure.
With regard to homeless policy.
And I'm not sure it is an answer to the question that you're asking, and that is, it would be nice. I have always wondered over the years. Somebody says, well, I've got this project. Well, on the bus tour, when we go by something in Battleground, we usually are close to where, it's almost always near where the last project was. And so we always get to see it. But on all of these other things, we never get to see what it is unless we have like the Salvation Army grand opening. And I wasn't able to make that. I was out of town then. But it would be nice to be able to see the results of some of these projects that we've awarded money to, because you don't have a real idea. I mean, when the presentation's there, it's usually not built, or they show bad things, you know, the no ramps for handicap or the doors don't fit for whatever, but we never see the end result. It would be nice sometime to see, it could even be in some of the presentations where if they are presenting an additional where they got money from the last year, that they say, this is what we did last year with the money you gave us, and now this is what we're proposing this year.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No. So we always go back out, or if we can't make it out, which we normally can, we always take after pictures, so we have before and after pictures, and so I could, that would be something we could easily put together. It wouldn't be, you know, exactly 1 year later or anything like
right.
that, but we could do a probably a regular presentation on these are the projects that finished in the last year, and here's how they went, and then you guys could kind of contribute.
Yeah, because it's almost always the same people on the board, and it would be nice to see an end result.
So we do report that to HUD, and that's part of the consolidated annual performance evaluation report in October, but we usually just say, like, we submitted the CAPR and everything went great, and so we can do a more robust presentation
yeah.
with pictures and maybe go back a couple of years to kind of get you guys caught up on some of the great work that you funded.
I think that'd be valuable.
So we'll add that to October.
I'm not looking to make meetings longer or anything like that, but it would be nice to see.
Yeah. All right. Do we need to adopt this or no? The draft of the
plan? I don't think there isn't any to adopt, but
okay.
We're happy to.
There's not a lot of specific dates, so.
All right. EHFH update.
So this is Evergreen Habitat for Humanity. And if you, there's a flyer, this letter from me to Josh Chownsley, he's the executive director of Evergreen Habitat. I want to just put this on your radar. You know, we've talked to you a couple times. We've had issues with Evergreen in terms of being unable to expend funds that they've been awarded. We had something totally different come up at the end of last year. We got a phone call from Fidelity National that asked us to, they wanted to do a payoff on one of our properties. And that just kind of brought to our attention that that property, you know, you do a payoff when, you know, there's a change in ownership, when the utilization of the property changes from homeownership to something else. I mean, there are trigger things that end the loan that was done. So what apparently happened with this property is that 3 years prior, the home had burned down and was not habitable. And the insurance paid the homeowner what you would expect to happen. And, you know, this is a home that had been funded with county home dollars in the amount of $41,000. And what you would expect to happen is if the home had been burned down, you know, by federal regulation, it needs to, you know, the property needs to be needs to be kept habitable. It needs to be occupied by a low-income eligible homeowner. And what should have happened is Evergreen should have notified us. The funds should have been used to rehabilitate the house or reconstruct the new one. And you know, they should have kept living in it. And what apparently happened is the insurance paid the house, the homeowner paid off their mortgage with Evergreen and has not lived in it for the past 3 years. And Evergreen now wants to buy that property back from the homeowner, which was triggering the payoff loan. And then Evergreen would, their intent was to sell it to another Habitat for Humanity recipient and, you know, build a house on it, you know, to use it in that way. But that's not allowable, you know, by any home regulations. And in this case, you know, what the letter basically states is, you know, there were many, many, many layers of regulations that were just completely disregarded in this whole thing. It wasn't up to us, to the county, to detect that. You know, we do our HQS inspections. We do, we do our due diligence. But once this project happened and it's over, it's on the recipient of the home funds to basically make sure that project remains in compliance with home funds until its completion. In this case, you know, when we would eventually in 20 years, 21 years, get the funds back. In this case, it was about, by the time we found out, it was about 1 year away from when it would have been complete, but it really happened 3 years ago. So what that is triggering us to do, you know, because, you know, what are we going to do about this now that we know? The first thing was we required Evergreen to return the full $41,000 to the county, and they have. And those funds are going back into the home funds that will be awarded and going into future projects. So we've already recouped the funds that we expended on that. The next thing we're going to do is basically audit, you know, do desk monitorings of all the properties that there are about 12, and they're listed in in this letter that you have a copy of, to make sure that they're in compliance with the home regulations that they're supposed to be doing. And based on what we find out from that, we may have other recommendations for you in terms of, you know, things like, you know, do we say that Evergreen is no longer eligible to, you know, to apply for new proposals for a certain amount of time? Is there anything else that needs to happen? You know, like, I don't, if we find that there are other serious violations, we may have other conversations in terms of funds that need to be returned and things like that. So, you know, because of the severity of that, we wanted to make sure you knew, that it was really considered a non-compliance with that. They were in violation of their deed of trust, in violation of their covenant with the county, and in violation with home regulations. It's important that you know that we had that interaction.
So this property is now just the fire property is owned by Evergreen Habitat for Humanity. They just own that.
Correct. They own it. We are divested of everything related to it. I don't think it's going to happen, you know. If HUD arrived today and were going to monitor us, and they selected this property as one of the properties that they monitored us on, we may or may not have issues, because they could look at it and say, okay, what have you done about it? Okay, you recouped all the funds. There really wasn't anything else you could do. You're divested. That's fine. I could see that, and there's a legitimate argument to that. Sam's chuckling in the back. You know, what they could also do is say, well, there is no out. You know, like, once you've spent the funds, once you put it into, like, the HUD home world, like, you have to comply with those regulations in perpetuity. And it's your responsibility. And what should have happened, in addition to Evergreen notifying you, is the home, you should have recouped the full $41,000. And you should have made sure that the homeowner not sold that property back to Evergreen, but sold it directly to another low-income household and had a house on it. So,
but somebody would have had to reconstruct it.
Correct. So, part of what we did in our due diligence is consult, you know, we went and consulted with RFPA, and, you know, like looking at the regulations, like, and really the most viable thing, I think there's a real legal argument for we've done what we should have done, and there isn't really another viable way to force ever, you know, they've already paid us back. Like, you know, your leverage isn't, you know, like, you know, how do you force them to, do they even have the funds to reconstruct? The low-income household certainly doesn't have the funds to reconstruct. They already paid that back. So, you know, the approach we're taking, and it's a legal approach, is it was a breach of contract. We've completely terminated the contract. We've recouped all the resources that were expended on that contract. We're following home regulations in that, recouping those funds and putting them into future projects into the program. You know, that's really, you know, due diligence. But I can't sit here and make a promise that if HUD landed, they wouldn't recommend that we did something else. I would challenge them, and I don't think that any of their staff in our shoes would have done anything different or been able to do anything different. But
does HUD have any clear policies around casualty incidents, fire, flood, earthquake, stuff like that, and loss of asset?
Yes and no. You know, like, and the reason I'm saying that is yes, in that this is 3 years after the fact that Evergreen disregarded. You know, they should have used that insurance money to because I think what happened is the fire happened, the homeowner wanted it out completely. There were some other issues there, like they had a marriage that dissolved, all kinds of things, you know, like, so they're like, we want out, you know. And what Evergreen should have done at the time was, we know you want out, the way you want out is not paying us back on mortgage, you need to rebuild that house with your insurance money, and you need to sell that house to another low-income household. But none of that happened, you know. So there isn't, so HUD does not have any policies or regulations that would really guide this situation after the fact. That didn't happen 3 years ago. Evergreen Habitat basically finished their contract with this household in violation of HUD rules, you know, has already spent that money that they recouped on whatever projects that they're doing. You know, so really, is there any HUD guidance for us on what we do finding this out after the fact? No.
Is there guidance? Just trying to be able to give Evergreen some coaching, or any applicant who suffers a casualty, if they had called. So that's the huge. That's the big lesson learned. They call. Is there HUD guidance? At that point, can you go to policy 125.6.3? Oh, casualty loss, here's what you do.
I think we would have, and we do. You know, we talk to our recipients on a very regular basis on all kinds of situations. Not related to these ones, like, you know, share having their fire at the share house. You know, just like every year, you know, we have conversations about, about different, hey, this came up, how do we navigate that? You know, the case here is Evergreen forgot. I mean, didn't contact us, didn't anything. And we're surprised when we're like, hey, we just just got this payoff request. What's going on?
Yeah, like, they forgot about the strings that were attached.
Yeah,
possible
strings.
Yeah. I get that. It's an unfortunate thing. I don't believe it was malicious. It could
I don't think it's malicious.
So let's say they have another fire, or anyone does has a fire, goes out of commission, rebuild it, makes sense, right? As soon as you possibly can. It's not going to be used as a residence for a while. There's nothing
correct
you can do about it. It gets rebuilt. The part that sounded really tricky to me is sell it to another low-income. How are they going to qualify?
Right.
Yeah.
So the only way to get it back in the system would be for Evergreen to facilitate that transaction. So basically what needed to happen is it needed to get reestablished again, and then Evergreen needed to put a qualifying family into that home. Did it have to be the very same one? Or could it have been any qualifying? Because people move out of Evergreen homes.
Yeah, all the time.
All the time.
Yes.
So whatever motivates them to move, there's a way to deal with that. So kind of at the end of the day, oh yeah, you got to rebuild it. But the transition of the person is no different than any other transition. It just so happened it was catalyzed by the fire and other circumstances. So they could have rebuilt it and placed somebody else in there as long as they're qualifying and then provide all that documentation.
Correct.
To you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Then that makes sense.
I can see, though, where a homeowner might get the money and there are issues at the household and they disappear. Now
but
you
that
got
was not this case. No.
But I can see where that would be another issue. Now, my thinking is the first thing I wouldn't do is call HUD and say, hey, what do I
what
do?
What do you do?
It's like now I got them on me. So anyway.
Well, one thing that the county does for all of our homeowner rehabs is we have the county listed as an additional insured. If any of those homeowners have our home burned down, we get notified by their insurance. We have to sign off on their check to know that they're going to be repairing the house. And I guess I would have assumed that Habitat had a similar thing, but and maybe they did, but they just decided not to resolve it by rebuilding.
Information.
What oversight is there with regard to this chapter of
it's another issue.
I mean, it's
correct.
There are ongoing management issues with this particular organization.
I'm not familiar enough with the Habitat organization to really be able to answer that. You know, but in terms of our oversight, so this was like a 2003, 2005 project. You know, it was well within Habitat's oversight, you know, portfolio. And, you know, our involvement would be triggered by things like it was, you know. Like, it should have been triggered by Habitat calling us saying, hey, we had a fire, you know, but they didn't. So it was triggered by the financial institution when there's the financial transaction.
3 years later.
Yes, 3 years later.
Right.
Well, because they're trying to sell it back to Habitat.
Sure.
But, but I can tell you in terms of our, you know, we're going to be looking at all the existing Habitat projects, and we're going to be doing our due diligence out of this. So there, you know, we've asked them to put the documentation together for all these properties, and we're going to be going through the documentation based on what we see that as necessary. We may be doing site visits, we may be doing more, and we'll let you know if we, if anything additional comes of it. But I can't answer what is their structure of oversight and how independent Evergreen Habitat is.
This is another question not really related to this particular incident, but what happens if a family that was qualifying is placed into a Habitat home? They go enhance their education, they come out and get some great employment, and now they're not qualified.
They would still be qualified.
Okay.
If it was that same family, they would stay qualified. It isn't that they would.
It's not an ongoing qualification. It's
yeah.
a qualification at a point in time.
Correct. But
as
if
opposed
that family,
to rental units.
What's that?
As opposed to a property that we build
correct.
Or renting.
Correct.
Okay.
So yes, this is ownership. You know, you know. But if that same household wanted, they've moved up, they have higher income, they have a different family composition, different needs, they wanted to, change house, then when they sold, they'd have to sell to, they'd still get some of the equity, but they'd have to sell to another home-eligible household.
Okay. That's going to be true for any of the ownership projects that we fund.
Correct.
And are there
proud ground, for example?
Are there policy parameters around, let's say they want to move up, but they want to retain ownership of that household? Do they have to use it as their primary residence, or can they, now we're landlords?
No, they have to use it as primary residence. It's built for home ownership.
Right. They can't flip habit at homes.
No.
They
have a business model.
And I don't mean to make it go even further, but what? When you said perpetuity, does that mean that house, that particular house, then, is a low-income house in perpetuity?
That's a good question. I would say, as far as we, the county, are concerned, we would completely be divested of anything regarding that house at the end of whatever date we said was the end date in the deed of trust and the covenant. And I don't think HUD would argue anything of that.
You can't keep track of it.
No. But by HUD regulations, they wouldn't hold us to anything beyond the deed of trust and the covenant. But I think it'd be arguable whether or not that house is supposed to stay affordable to a low-income household in eternity, but that's, do you have any different answer to that?
Well, HUD, the affordability period that HUD required for this home is 20 years, and then usually the county will make it as our option an additional 20 years, and that's really so 40 years is probably the max on any of the properties that we have.
40 years of something.
I wonder how this.
And that's compliance,
Yeah.
So that's all. I just want to make sure that you had copies of the letter, you were updated on that specific case, and if more follows, there'll be more to follow.
Okay, so we're scheduled for our next meeting then, February 10th. And then it sounds like the 11th we'll have our best tour. Anything else?
February 10th is our next meeting?
Yes. Well, that's a long one.
Bus ride on the 11th.
Yeah. Anything else for the good of the order?
Move to adjourn.